This is the Business of College Sports podcast with your host, the founder of businessofcollegesports.com, Christy Dosh. Find her on Twitter and Instagram at SportsBizMiss.
Welcome to the Business of College Sports podcast. I'm your host, Christy Dosh, the Sports Biz Miss. Thank you for joining us today. If you are a return listener, I appreciate you coming back for more. And if you are brand new to the podcast, welcome. I am so thankful to have you here. I'm also really thankful for our guest this week, James Coleman. I first met James at my husband's radio station, 1010 XL in Jacksonville, Florida. James does a fantastic show at 1010 XL with his friend Denny. And as I thought about the aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement that we have and have not covered here on the podcast, it occurred to me that James would make an excellent guest. He is a former starter at Florida State. He was the member of three ACC conference championship teams from 2002 to 2005. I'm going to really try to forget that he's an FSU grad because, as many of you know, I'm a Florida grad. But really, James is a fantastic guy. I've gotten to meet him several times over the years at my husband's station. And I have listened to some of the shows he's had in recent weeks and have just been really impressed with sort of the level of the conversation being had about being a Black college student athlete and about what that experience is like and about what we're seeing right now in terms of Black student athletes really using their voice and using their platform to demand change. And so I'm thankful that he was willing to come chat on the podcast, not only about his experience as a student athlete, but also everything that we have seen in the news over the last couple of weeks with student athletes who are calling out coaches, who are demanding changes to names on buildings and all sorts of other issues that have come to light in recent weeks. So I appreciate that he took the time to sit down and chat about us with this. So without further ado, here's my interview with James Coleman.
Hi, James. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me.
You, I think, are only my second former student athlete to come on. I had Taj Boyd on, I don't know, episode two or three pretty early on, and we did a deep dive on NIL rights. And I want to talk to you about that as we get kind of towards the end of this. But I thought we could start out by talking a little bit about your experience as a student athlete, and particularly your experience as a Black student athlete, because I think what we've seen over the last few weeks is increasingly Black student athletes have spoken up and talked about issues within their current and former programs. And I have a lot of different examples I want to sort of go through, but I thought we could start by talking a little bit about your experience. You know, was there anything about your experience as a student athlete or even particularly at FSU that you think was different than maybe the experience that your white teammates had?
I think that's an interesting question. And I'm a history major, and I really like delving into all kinds of, in particular, African-American history and U.S. Mm-hmm. history. I had a great opportunity this past week to interview the original four African-American athletes who integrated Florida State from an athletic perspective. And I was blessed to have those guys come before me and other people go through some different things and help change the climate. Mm-hmm. So that nothing really earth shattering happened at Florida State during my time because we were really good. Mm-hmm. And the people before me were good. I was on the downward trend that they call the dynasty. So as long as I excelled on the field, the racism that I felt was more implied. It was not overt. We didn't have social media. Social media was just starting to come into fold. So, mm-hmm. The people, and I hate to use this because it sounds almost elitist, but the people who have platforms deserve the platform. Now, everybody has a platform. Mm-hmm. The guy in the front of the liquor store, the guy who's the janitor who's disgruntled with life, everybody has a platform with social media to be able to say what they want to say. Mm-hmm. So you're no longer hidden, and everybody has access to you. So you're no longer hidden from your athletic gifts don't hide you anymore. And we didn't have we never had a major social issues like what they have right now. Like the only ones that I remember growing up, I remember Rodney King, but I was 91. So I think it was 91, 92. So I would have been like 7 or 8 years old.
And I'm just a couple of years older than you. So I don't remember much either.
Yeah. So I remember my mom watching it. I remember Can We All Just Get Along and some of the satire stuff that came along with it. But I do know these young men have seen in the last 5 to 6 years, they've seen, perfect example, a young man, Tamir Rice, would have been graduating high school this year. And he was shot in an open carry state for people thinking he had a gun in a park when it was a toy gun and before he even had the opportunity. So this recruiting class saw that. They've seen, obviously, George Floyd. They've seen Eric Garner. They've seen Trayvon Martin, who would have graduated from college. They've seen numerous things they've seen. And then when the unrest came, they used their platform. So I was kind of in that in-between, like kind of happy time. But what I did see, what I did get the opportunity, though, was to see how I could change stereotypes of what people thought the hood was or what they thought African-American men were or African-American athletes, thinking that we were dumb jocks. I graduated in 3.5 years, not because I was a stellar student, but just because I went through school. But I graduated. My sister was a collegiate athlete as well at Florida State, all ACC track athlete, and she graduated in 4 years with a double major. And we're from the projects, we're from the hood. And so it's just, that was really the more of the thing is people, I interact with people and they think because of the neighborhood that I'm from, I'm supposed to be the rappers in this, which right. It could be. And I'm from those areas and I have friends who are like that, but I also came out of that. And my goal is to do some other things. So that would be the stuff that you see is that when people, it's always everywhere you go, people are suggesting that, oh, you're not what I thought. And then my mother taught sarcasm very, very well in my family. Like, we are a family of sarcastic people. And I tell, you're not the white person that I thought. Like, I would tell them the same thing. I thought all you guys were, thought you all were airheads and from the valley. Or I thought you were all rich, or I thought you were this. So, but again, that was the things that my encounters were. And I think the beautiful thing about it is what started me, and I actually heard the original four talk about this, they all went to integrated high schools. They were the first people to go. So when we went to Florida State, it wasn't a shop. I went to Florida State Developmental Research School, which aka Florida High, which is on FSU's campus. And it's a direct reflection of the state of Florida's population per the census. So it's like 60% of 60% white, blah, 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 all these different things. I went to an alternative middle school because I got into a lot of fights that was 98% black. So I went from a 98% African-American school to a school where I was shell-shocked. But had I not had that transition, I probably wouldn't have been as good at Florida State. I wouldn't have been able to accept it.
When I think something you brought up, I've got a question for you. You talked about the student athletes now and sort of what they've had to see and emotionally process with the deaths, the murders that we've seen over the past, couple few months. And obviously there are examples that go back even further than that. But there's been a lot during, just the last couple of months, it seems like. With the pandemic, it becomes so tough to keep track of time anymore. And it's all sort of happening, but it seems like a lot happened in a small window of time for them to process emotionally. And I had Tim Duncan, the AD at University of New Orleans, on a couple of weeks ago to talk about an instance where he was racially profiled up in Massachusetts while he was back packing up his house to get his family moved down to New Orleans. And we talked about how he decided to use that encounter to speak to his student athletes when he got back. And he said that they took their 3 African-American administrators and had them talk to only their African-American student athletes and decided that that was where the discussion should start. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen talked about a lot in the news lately is Marvin Wilson at FSU, who refuted, you know, the head coach saying that he corresponded with every single player individually about George Floyd's death. And Marvin Wilson said, no, you didn't. And it made me think about, you know, how Tim Duncan decided to approach his student athletes versus what we were hearing coming out of other schools. As a former student athlete, and I know now you work with athletes as well, what do you think is the sort of job of a head coach in this situation or of an administration? How should they be talking to particularly their Black student athletes about what's happening?
Well, it should be a twofold thing. And I think the biggest thing with all of this is education. And education, like not in a book sense, but in a real world application sense. Me and my radio partner Denny had a great dialogue, and I'm not using him to bash him or anything. But when I hear people say I didn't know, in the information age, ignorance is a choice. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that they tell us. You have Google right here at your. And now you should ask what the right thing, because you can go down a wormhole, but what should happen so that we can advance the conversation is we have to understand colloquialisms and language, and words have meaning, especially to the African-American community. We call things like word is bond. Your word is your bond. Mm-hmm. You know, your name is attached to your word and your actions, and they mean everything. And for a new coach, that means everything. I had Mike Norvell on an interview of a podcast I have called 36 Degrees. And I said, Coach, why should they trust you? Mm-hmm. Why should a new athlete trust you when the coach who was there before, Willie Taggart, who looked like them, said he was going to help them, and he didn't, seemingly. And Jimbo left them. Why should they trust? He said, they shouldn't trust me. Every day I have to go out and I have to earn their trust. So when you take that and then you see the thing now, improper wording. He did reach out to everybody in theory, but the text and what it implied, because he sent a text message, mm-hmm. and about 50 to 60 athletes responded. But what he implied is, and this is where it was dangerous, and I'm glad it got cleared up, is that I did more for my little color boys than what every other coach is doing.
Right.
And it was a sense of pride. It would have been a home run article that was written, because here's the strategicness in it. And why people who are saying it, and why it's detrimental, because media influences thought. And the way that we do things, it influences people's thought. He didn't go to War Chant. He didn't go to 247, the local beat, where they don't have any African-American writers. There are two African-American writers on FSU's beat.
Wow.
I'm technically not a beat writer. I have something that I'm trying to do, and I cover FSU because it's my alma mater, but I cover SEC, ACC, and the NFL. Mm-hmm. So that's me. You didn't go to me, which people would have been like, they would have been like, James Jobs to defend the program. This is alma mater. You went to Tayshaun Reed, who no longer covers FSU, by the way. But he's an African-American journalist for The Athletic, and you told an African-American journalist what you were doing for your African-American athletes. So you got a cosign automatically from what he was doing. If that wasn't strategic and it was dumb luck, then you're stupid, which I don't believe. I don't think he's stupid at all. I believe they knew what that could do for it. So when you use that word, it's those words, they're very, it means something. So when Marvin sees that, and Marvin knows that, wait a minute, you ain't talking to me, I see you. That's when that comes in. And then that's when I think Marvin actually realized the power that he has as a student athlete.
Right.
I don't think these kids realized, like, we knew the power we had, but the athletic directors tipped the hat of just how much power they had for the COVID situation. See, they're pushing COVID and making these guys go out without understanding it. Because if you don't have football, you don't get your TV dollars, you don't get the booster money, and they're like, we could lose our entire athletic department. So what you did was you just show weakness. So now I know you need me just as much as y'all think I need you now. Because mm-hmm. if I don't get out there and I don't play on that field, you don't get your ticket money. You don't, if you don't play on the field, you don't get the TV revenue. If you don't get the TV revenue, that means you got outstanding bills, because most of y'all are playing catch up and playing with Joneses, because you're trying to compete with Alabama and trying to compete with these other people, which is such an unfair playing field. And we also know we should have been paid. So now the public perception of people saying we have to play college football, even if students don't come. So now the public is actually saying, wait a minute, these guys ain't really students. These guys are chattel for the university that the universities won't even be able to function without them. And then now they realize that, yo, if you want me to play, you better do what I say. So now you see, not just at Florida State, where Marvin says, we ain't doing nothing else for the rest of the year until this gets handled. That immediately caused action from the president. The president had to lessen the rule, because there was supposed to be no large gatherings on campus. Mm-hmm. The president immediately signed something. You guys can meet. You need to have a team meeting. This happened, so 12 o'clock at night is when it happened. I remember getting updates from parents about Mike Norvell at 7, and the president let them have a meeting at 9 a.m. So you saw a change happen within 9 hours. Now, again, to Mike Norvell's credit, everything that he's done has been to show, I'm sorry, but Oklahoma State with Mike Gundy wearing an OAN shirt. I don't care what people believe about it or not. His running back was hurt, and they're like, well, he's just sensitive, and Mike doesn't need to do nothing. Well, that running back represents 328-plus carries, 2,000-plus rushing yards, and 21-plus TDs. That guy means something to Mike Gundy, because if he doesn't play, Mike Gundy is losing a significant part of his offense, which is a significant part of his salary, which is $5 million a year. When you're making money off of – when I realize your $5 million is off of me as the African-American – you're going to do what I say, and you have to bet on black. Because the last time I checked, ever since Bear Bryant took that ass whipping by USC, African-American players have been very prevalent into this sport. So that's kind of where I think guys are – it's like three to four generations removed are coming in and seeing that this generation is doing the same thing. And people don't like that. Anytime change is being ushered, there's a painful process in it. So people have to get on there. But it's great to see the student athletes have more balls than the pro athletes.
Well, and I think what you said that's interesting and that I hope people paid attention to is the situation the pandemic has created has hammered home for these black student athletes the important role that they play in generating revenue, not just for the football program, but for the entire athletic department, and that has perhaps given them the sort of confidence or the push to be more vocal about what's happening. Do you think this would have all looked different if there was no pandemic, but we still had George Floyd being murdered and we still had these other instances of violence, and particularly police violence against black people? Does this all play out differently if we're not in the middle of a pandemic where student athletes are so aware of their value?
I think it's a perfect storm or a perfect gumbo of everything. So like the pandemic gives you a chance to go back home and see that, and you're hearing about your value, and you're hearing about, you know, schools, I need this. Like, because for so many years, the people who were the most important were the boosters. Like, that was who the school catered to. So, you know, if the booster says this, booster says that, then you gotta bow down to the guy that's paying right $1 million a year check. But now you see this. And I think there was no – normally the student athlete can be – like I said with me, like I was for four years, I was effectively shielded from a lot because of my level of ability. And even now, like the way I – my lifestyle now shields me from way more than what I've encountered now. When I encounter it now – it wakes me up a whole hell of a lot. And even then, when I encountered it in college, it woke me up a lot more. But normally, you're just like every, you know, hey, if you know that there's a threat every day, it's kind of like you're like, if you're like an animal in the jungle, your instincts are everything that you're raised to do is to protect yourself from the potential of threats. So when you know you've got class from 8 a.m. till 12, you got workouts from 12 to 2, you got film study from 2 to 3, you got practice from 3:30 to 6:30, you got chow from 6:30 to 7:30, study hall up until 9 p.m., your day is so regimented that you don't get a chance to really worry about what's going on. You may look at your phone every now and then, but you don't have phones at practice or in your meetings. So you're really away from your phone for 4 to 5 hours a day. But now during quarantine, you're on your phone. You see Twitter. You see this stuff. You're getting mad. And now you're around your parents. The biggest thing that these things do is the conversations that get had. And you're having conversations with your mom and dad that's sitting in town. Your dad is stewing. Hell, I've had to have a conversation with my 7-year-old son about what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, like, it makes you mad. So, and now you have to, and now you're telling your son to be careful, like your older son, like it's Marvin Wilson's age. You're telling him to be careful. Like, don't go out here. Don't do something stupid. Like, keep your nose clean. Man, don't even carry money. Use a credit card. Then they can't say it's counterfeit. A lot of things of that nature. So these guys are stewing, and you're having conversations, and then it gets – and then I think it was the back-to-back-to-back nature. Yeah. The Aubrey situation that happened in Georgia. I forget his last name, but Aubrey. Ahmaud Arbery. And you see where he's just running, and people think he fits the description. And the crazy part about that is we wouldn't have heard of it. That had been already out for 60 days before you had heard about it. That was pre-COVID. But now you're seeing that it was hidden. It wasn't going to go. And like, man, so we could just be hunted when I'm working out. Then you hear about Breonna Taylor in Louisville, where, you know, it was a no-knock raid, and a man who had his license to carry, who was a Second Amendment holder, and, you know, police come in, don't announce themselves, and the neighbors are saying that, and he shoots, and then the young lady gets hit with a volley of shots. Mm-hmm. And then you hear about the cover-up and how things were happening, and then you see the George Floyd situation, and then you see the situation that happened in Atlanta, justified or not justified or whatever you believe, it's just a lot that you take in, and now you get back, and then you see, and then you don't know, like, you're back, you're away from home now, and your coach is your father figure, your assistant coach, your head coach, and a lot of these parents can't really communicate to you, so they're asking the coaches, talk to our sons, and the coach says that, and it's not what happens, and then you just go do that. But it's, again, it's a great thing because Texas is doing something similar. Texas A&M is doing something with Kelly Mond, the quarterback. Is basically, and people are researching these monuments that they have to go in and play for. It is so crazy, like, to even think about it. Like, a lot of the schools that a lot of these guys come from out of, your Andrew Jackson's, your Lee, your Jeb Stewart's, they're all, like, at one point they were predominantly white neighborhoods, but now it's the hood. So you have a bunch of African-American kids who have gone to schools that were named after people who hated their very existence.
And Texas was one of the things I wanted to ask you about because, you know, the situation there, as I understand it, and as much as I have read about it at this point, is that you've got multiple student athletes, and it sounds like not just football, from various sports, who have said that they're not going to, you know, host recruits or attend donor functions or play until a series of steps have been taken. You know, they want the Eyes of Texas song to be replaced. There's some building names that were brought up. And I think that's happening on more than just one campus, but Texas obviously is such a big brand. That's the one we see most in the media. You know, as a, you know, former student athlete, is that something you think student athletes should be using their voice for? And if so, you know, how do they go about that? How do you, you know, sort of pick your battles, and how do you use the power that you have to get the change you want to see?
I think whatever you're passionate about, you should use that, use the platform that you have to push and bring forth change. So when you have monument, like when you find, like, so actually, let's see if I can find it. But when we don't know everything, none of us are born knowing everything. So when you find out about something, it's, and you're educated, it's your responsibility to change once you are educated on said thing. And I believe, like, you know, symbolism is dope and everything, and I think that's a good part. That's a good first step. But there should be some true change, and that comes from listening to people who have a little bit more time to create change, and using your lane to be able to help foster that. We all don't need to be in the streets marching. We all don't need to be doing these different things, but everybody can have a different lane that's headed toward the same goal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where athletes, because you're visible, you step behind somebody and you can truly push something. This is a quote from General Lee. The circumstances which govern actions change, and conduct must conform to the new order of things. So basically, when the times change, you've got to adapt.
Yeah.
And that's what we've always been slow to do in America, unless it messes with the money. And that's why I believe student athletes in general, entertainment, because that's really what it is. Entertainment in general can bring about change faster because everybody, that's what people like. We exalt celebrity for whatever reason. So since we exalt celebrity, it's a celebrity's job to speak on those things in which we want change.
Which I think leads to an interesting question. I was thinking in my head, I wonder if we'll see change happen faster on college campuses because of what student athletes are stepping up and doing right now versus some of the debate we're seeing about monuments that are off campus that are, you know, in major cities and that sort of thing. And that, you know, for example, I'm from Atlanta and there's always been a, before now, I would call it something like a vocal minority who wants to, take the etching off the side of Stone Mountain. And I grew up like right at the edge of Stone Mountain. And I think that the call for that is getting louder and louder, particularly over the last couple of months. But do you think that we'll see change faster on these college campuses because there are such high profile student athletes who are getting involved and calling for the change?
Yes. And again, like I said, everything is about bottom line. The other thing that happens to college campuses is the fact that they didn't play any spring sports and they didn't play the winter sport championships. So there's a deficit right now. And so like if they threaten to not play, that creates a larger deficit.
Right.
So if a guy is just like, I don't want to go to a dorm. I don't want to stay in a dorm of a guy who hated my existence.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easy change. That's not something you need legislation for. That's something that you just need the president to just change the name of the dorm, change the name of somebody else, which you can understand. But I think it ushers in a bigger, or I hope it ushers in a bigger thing. And I think University of Texas guys had this in their own policy. I think some other schools have it to where you're asking the university to do more in the inner city or more in the communities that look mm-hmm. like people like you. And you're asking them for better diversity hires and more grace given to those people. So like when you look at a compliance department or you look at the athletic department that is really fueled by 70% of the athletes looking like one minority, but there isn't very good representation of that. I'm not suggesting 70% of your athletic department needs to look like that, but when it's less than 5%, that's a problem.
Right.
You should be able to look in there and see people who are like you, because again, it gives you an idea of other stuff, the other things that you could do once your athletic career is over. So those are things that I hope that the student athletes are moving toward, because if it's really just about stopping chance, that's cool. But that doesn't affect real change. And people can still say those chants. They just, you know, in the comfort of their home. But until fiscally, you have things in place that help level the playing field, that help you have an opportunity, then you're just wasting your voice. That's my opinion on it.
Well, you led me right into my next question without even knowing what it was. But I am a UF law grad, and so you know, I paid attention. The day we're recording this, the news just came out yesterday that UF will no longer use the Gator Bait chant. And because I went to UF Law, you know, I have a lot of friends in my network who are UF grads, and I really saw a 50-50 split between my friends on Facebook and Twitter over the last 24 hours. Those who think it's the appropriate thing to do to remove that chant, and those who are really upset about it being removed. And for those who are upset about it being removed, they are mostly linking to comments made by Florence Wright, who came up with the idea for that chant. He is Black, and he says he doesn't support the removal and that it wasn't meant in that way. How do you feel about it as a Black person who is not a UF grad? So FSU, even, you have no allegiance to UF whatsoever. What's your take on that situation?
I'll be honest with you. We use that as a troll to Florida fans. As an African American, it's one of the things that we use against other, like when we want to make a joke that cuts. How could you be at a university that believes that it's appropriate to chant about something that we were used as?
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it was meant. It's about what it was. Like some things we can kind of have a little bit of a change for, but sometimes it doesn't work like that, and it definitely doesn't work like that on the grand scheme. So again, to educate people on that, you can look it up. There's periodicals or there's advertisements in newspapers. There's plenty of information that shows where African Americans or Black babies were used to be able to get alligators out of swamps so that people can catch them and do whatever they want to do with that. It wasn't now to the defense of whoever used those things. The African American was compensated, so which was an excuse. We have African Americans that want to do this. That doesn't make it right, though. And I know Mr. Wright has, you know, it was about to launch a very profitable clothing thing towards that. All right.
Yeah.
Towards that. And I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's
and
okay. I saw that same thing, that he had some apparel and some commercial products he was getting ready to launch that included the Gator Bait language on it. So that perhaps colors his opinion on this a little bit.
So I'll give an example from my own. So again, we have clothes. This is what we call ourselves, especially those of us who played under Bobby Bowden. We call ourselves Dope Boys. And that is in reference to the stadium in which we play under, which is Doak S. Campbell Stadium. There's information that's out now about Doak Campbell being a very popular segregationist. Did not believe in integration at all. Now, he did some other things, like he did give money to FAMU. He did that. Same as Ben Hill Griffin, same as O'Connell. A lot of things that people, again, are going to actually probably end up coming up and seeing if it's time to rename them. If FSU said, and if I have a teammate, Kendrick Scott, who's leading a alumni who I know very well, who's leading a petition to try to change the name of the stadium. If they change the name of the stadium, then I will change the name of my brand in my own podcast, because it's no longer that. It doesn't mean enough to me. Like, if it's what means for me is playing for my university. A chant and a name is not what made me go to that university.
Right.
But it can be something that can deter somebody. And you never want to inadvertently hurt somebody. And the one thing I always bring up, and this isn't anything negative to them, but like anytime a Black person says, this offends me, it's snowflake, or I know Black people who don't do this or this. But let me say something anti-Semitic. It's not, I have a Jewish friend who says this, I have this. No, we all have been truly educated on the horrors mm-hmm. of the Holocaust. The thing that all of this really comes down to is we have not been truly educated on the horrors of the Mid-Atlantic slave trade, on how it was legalized, like your skin color was essentially mechanized against you. There were legal things that made you a slave at one point. It was, yes, there were black slave owners. Yes, there are black. You can go and find the anomaly. But for the vast majority of African Americans existed here in the United States, it hasn't really been that great. My mother was the first person to attend an integrated school. So, like, I'm literally, like, people, I'm less than a generation removed from the horrors of a lot of the stuff that we had that went on. So I think sometimes we just got to look at it, what's the worth of it? And I actually I love what, I don't even know how, I always confuse how to say his last name, but I love what UF's president has actually done. The other side of it is, I know that's not what we asked for. Most black people would have never asked for it. And most people didn't know what Gatorade was to their defense.
No.
But now that you know what it is, you should, it's about, you're armed with knowledge. What are you going to do now that you know about it? Are you going to say, I don't care? Or are you going to like move forward?
Yeah, I mean, once I saw, when the news came out yesterday, I was not aware of black children being used as gator bait. And I immediately started seeing tweets where people had like postcards and advertisements depicting it. And then I started reading articles about, you know, and I spent time yesterday learning more about it before I ever retweeted or said anything about it, because I knew that I had a big UF fan base that follows me because I went to UF, and I wanted to know more before I shared anything about it. And after reading and seeing those things, you can't unlearn that. And I personally can't be okay ever using that chant again. And I mean, I've you know, taken part in that chant more times than I can count, at the stadium, you know, in a house watching with friends, and I will never see it the same way ever again, because now I do have that education around it. And so for me as a UF grad, I don't want to hear it again. I think it's great that we decided we need to, you know, ban that and move beyond it. And for, you know, the people who are fighting so hard for it, I don't understand why they're fighting so hard for it and why their affection for it outweighs what it does actually represent. So, but I didn't know anything about it before yesterday, to be honest. And so I think all of us are getting an education on a lot of things we knew very little about. I grew up in a very white area. There were a handful of black students at my high school, and I don't think I got a lot of that education growing up. You get the typical, you know, sort of spoon-fed information about slavery in, you know, your textbooks, but I don't think I learned that much. And I wasn't around more diverse people until I got into college and then into law school and out in the working world and working in sports and that sort of thing. But I think it is incumbent upon us. You said at the very beginning, you know, the information is out there. All you have to do is hit Google and you can get educated on these issues. You know, and I obviously encourage people to do that, but I'm going to link a couple of the things I read about the gator bait issue in the show notes for those people who haven't already taken the time to do it. I will do the work for you and give you a few of the links that I read, because I do think it's important, especially for my UF fan base, to understand what this is really all about.
Something I think everybody should do, and it's free, is go to Washington, D.C. and go to the African American History Museum. Mm-hmm. Its design is really crazy, right? So what you see is essentially where we're at today. And you have to take an elevator, and it goes down like four floors. And it represents the 400 years. So each floor is one of the centuries. And it's heavy. When I say heavy, I know a lot. But like, you literally learn what it's been like since the first African-Americans entered here. And it's so heavy that they have this thing called a reflection pool. Like, it's supposed to relax you. Like, you literally got to walk through, because there's people who are crying, there's people who are doing all kinds of other stuff. You literally see all the horrors. And it's almost like a triumph of tragedy, everything that African Americans have been through. Now, the cool part is, after you go through that, the top four floors are all about African-American achievement. So, mm-hmm. like, you see, like, how cool it is to be, like, which is something that I America's dope in the fact that out of many, we are one. And I, like, I never, like, if you're Italian, be proud to be Italian-American. If you're Chinese, be proud to be Chinese. If you're Black, be proud to be Black. It's just sometimes it's never told how dope it is to be who you are. And, like, so you learn about all the bad stuff, and then you learn how dope you are. But the reason why I say go to it is that sometimes you got to really get a crash course on why something might be offensive. Mm-hmm. Like is even the art, even the way those Gator Bait things are drawn, they're drawn in blackface. And blackface is about, is what people would consider the hideous features of, or the unattractive features of what an African American is. Big lips, big eyes, big nose, tar skin. That's where things like Tar Baby came from and a lot of stuff like that. Like, so those are things that when it's put out, it's not meant to be, it's not meant to show the positive side of it. So again, it's just when you learn something, it's like, what does it really, really mean to me? And if you correct me if I'm wrong on this, they're not banning it. They're just banning the band and for FUF to leave the chair. Well, you can go say Gator Bait on your own if you want to. They're not going to kick you out of the stadium if you say it, are they?
No, but I would hope that UF fans would educate themselves on this more and that no one would want to say it anymore. I know that's not
that's what it, no, I'm saying, and that's where I'm getting at.
But you're right. The band just isn't going to play it.
It goes to something where it's just like the N-word. Right? And I won't go in because I just, but it's like nobody's stopping you from saying the word. We're just hoping you have the civility to understand what the word implies and that you can't, and you just shouldn't use it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like there's literally no law against using any word. It's just, as my mother taught me growing up, which is crazy that, you know, how you get taught this in an inner city environment and the things that happen. She said, anything that you do in life, be prepared for consequences, mm-hmm. positive or negative. You can do whatever you want to do. The thing is that there's going to be a consequence for the said outcome, for said thing that you've done. Right. So that's really what it comes down to.
There was something, I don't want to veer totally off course, but you said something earlier and I made a note about it because I wanted to remember to go back to it before we finished up. When you were talking about Dope Campbell, and I was sort of thinking about the buildings and the stadiums that were starting to hear, you know, sort of an uprising for changing the names. And a lot of the names, most of the names that are at issue right now are names that are not contractually obligated to be on these buildings and stadiums and structures because they were named back when it was more of an honorary sort of thing versus the more modern era where now people are paying for naming rights on both academic buildings and on athletic buildings. Now, some schools and even some conferences are still very much against paid naming rights on buildings. But look, I work with a consulting firm and I've worked on naming rights deals before. And some of the naming rights deals I've seen have kind of like a morals clause that would be similar to what we hear about with professional athletes, the clauses they might have in their sponsorships where, you know, when they go out and do something offensive or illegal or, you know, whatever against the morals of the company can yank their sponsorship. I have seen a few naming rights deals that have had what I would essentially consider to be a morals clause, but quite frankly, it's a minority of them. Most of them don't have anything like that. And I wonder, as a consultant who works on this kind of stuff, not even wonder, I mean, I now feel strongly that there's got to be something, if you're going to take money from somebody to put their personal name or their business name on your building on campus or your stadium or your arena or whatever it is, you've got to do some pretty serious research into who that person or who that company is. And you got to have some sort of out clause, some sort of morals clause in the contract, because if we start talking about stadiums and arenas that have been named after people and corporations under contract for, you know, tens of millions of dollars, taking the name off is going to be a little more complicated complicated than it is if it's just, you know, a building named in honor of somebody. And as somebody who does that kind of consulting work, like, I made myself a note here to talk to the people I consult with about how we should do this going forward, because I don't think that kind of research is being done. And I don't think those kind of clauses are being included in the contracts. And it's probably going to come back to bite somebody in the butt before too long.
Yeah. And I think we also, there is a danger, not danger is the wrong word, but there is some stuff that we have to use some brevity with. And, you know, you can't, it's very difficult to, there are things that we can say that are universally immoral. If you find out somebody's a rapist, if you find out somebody killed people, if you find out somebody literally went out of their way to hold people back, those are people that I would not want to be associated with. And you hear businesses all the time say the values that this person represents does not represent the values of blah, blah, blah. Anytime somebody gets in trouble. So you have to have that same, yeah, it has to be consistent from top to bottom, but it's like, just goes to the Doe Campbell thing. Like, it's hard when people ask me, like, and if as a African-American man, yes, I don't want to play under the stadium of a person that didn't want me to be there. That being said, at the time, segregation was the worldview. So I can understand, doesn't mean I like it. I can understand why he did that. Mm-hmm. So like, for me to punish somebody based on the values that we have in 2020, yes, it's easy to do that. But what was the whole world like and what other things that he did? So like, a lot of, but it goes back to what you said. I just need to know who the person is, and you have to do the research, and then you get to get a chance to really make a choice. Yeah. We all have a ton of things that we do that we make the best choice with the information that we have. Like, I'm a sneakerhead. I really like tennis shoes. Most of my tennis shoes are made in China. But I also believe in human rights, and I believe in making money. Like, I believe in, people should make their fair share. It's a very huge dichotomy right there. So like, there's some things that people could do better, but like, man, whew, do I want my Jordans to cost me $300 regular price, or do I like the fact that they cost $190 if I get them? So those are things that we do in every day. So imagine how escalated it gets when we actually get to a situation where it's millions of dollars involved and it's a college or it's a business. So, but I think that, to me, with schools that are struggling against the Alabamas and the SECs, or so if I'm an ACC school and I don't have the booster structure that a lot of these other places have, I'm trying to find money in every creative way possible. Yep. And there's banks. There's like, that's why I think what the Jaguars do is amazing. It's very difficult for TIAA Bank to like have a bad day unless they get hit with lending practices. But that's a whistleblowing thing. And most of the time they collapse and another bank buys them. So it's like, it just changes like that. So that's the money part is where it gets interesting. And to be honest with you, until they really start paying athletes, I really don't care how hard they get hit.
Well, you talked earlier about sort of what student athletes can do right now to use their voice. Most of the people who listen to this podcast work in an athletic department, or they work with a service provider, a consultancy that provides services to athletic departments. This is mostly people who work in and around college athletics. Sort of imparting, what is your advice to them on how they can best support their Black student athletes right now?
The best way you could do is use the word that everybody either hates or doesn't understand, is use your privilege. And it's not necessarily about your skin tone, and it doesn't mean you didn't work hard. It just means that we all have certain privileges that we've worked hard for, or we inherently get, that give us open doors to places that we wouldn't normally have it. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to your African-American athletes, educate yourself on what they mean, on what police brutality means from the eyes of an African-American. What is it like going home after the club, or even if you didn't go to the club, what is it like driving home at 1 o'clock in the morning from the stadium as a student athlete and you see a police officer come behind you? What thoughts do you have? and why do you have those thoughts? Okay, what is policing like for you? So once you learn that and you listen to understand, then you start working on ways to actually bring about change. Because one thing I understood, and I was listening to the comedian Dave Chappelle talk about this, is that there is some white people or some people in general who have literally never had a bad experience with a police officer or in general. And that's a phenomenal life. So you can't wrap your mind around why somebody else would distrust because every interaction you've had. I liken it to this. If I tell you that this food that I've had, this dish my mother makes, I like gumbo. So my mother makes this gumbo and it's so delicious, man. You gotta try it. And I sell you on it, right? And you eat it and you're like, eh. Like, instead of me bashing you for not liking what I like, if I love you or if I'm really, like, you're really one of my people, well, why didn't you like it? Well, I have a shellfish allergy. Oh, okay. Well, maybe if I take the shrimp out and it's just chicken and sausage, like, maybe you'll like it then. And I change it, and then, you know, God forbid, you like it. That's not how Americans talk to each other about this. They talk to each other about how can you get pulled over, but when I tell, how can you hate the police? I'm like, well, I don't hate them. I distrust them because of situations like me. I've been detained in front of my own house because a police officer didn't believe I lived in. Like, until you felt that, that's an not only embarrassing, it's infuriating because the person is terrified of you just because there's some mental thing that makes them afraid. I'm afraid of the black person in some of these police officers' head. Like, I don't know who this person is because I've never encountered them before. But I do know this. I look like them, apparently, and I don't want to play Russian roulette. So those are, with my experience with a police officer, with anybody. So those are the things that we can do is listen to our guys so that we can understand, so that we can translate to others. And then from there, build rapport and relationships to where we can actually change this. Because it's not for the African American or the person who's oppressed to change. It's not their problem. It's your problem for having an issue with them that you don't even understand why you have one. Yeah. So until that change happens, all it is rhetoric. So those are, other than that, bring somebody along. I'm a big proponent in if you have a skill and you have a talent, the best way to love somebody and to build somebody up is to teach that person everything that you know. Because if you can replicate yourself with somebody who looks different than you, you just gave somebody a leg up and a chance. And fiscally, it's time, talent, and treasure. If you spend your time, talent, and treasure with somebody else, you typically have to have an affinity for them.
I think that's great advice. And I think I'm actually going to link down in the show notes to a few books that were recommended to me that I am currently, one I'm in the middle of reading, and the others I've got up to read next to help educate myself better, because I am a white woman and I want to learn more. And the one thing I have heard and listened to is my black friends who have said, don't come to me and ask me to educate you. It's not my job. And I have taken that very seriously. And I have asked when there is something that I need their personal opinion on, or I've looked and I found conflicting information. Yeah, I mean, there are situations where I have felt like it made sense to go to one of my friends and ask a genuine question, but I'm not going and saying, you know, how can I do better? What should I be doing? Or what should I be reading? You know, I have tried really hard to go out and find my own resources. So I am happy to share with people the resources I found, which you may or may not find helpful, but I will link to a few books. I'm in the middle right now of one called White Fragility that I'm reading actually with a whole group that's facilitated by a friend that's biracial. And that group still hasn't met yet. So happy to link to that too, if people want to join our sort of book club to discuss it more in depth, but I'll put that down in the show notes for everybody. And also I'm going to put down some links for the things I read about Gator Bait as well, in the hopes of changing some of the minds of some of my, my fellow Gator friends. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on and spending time with us. I feel like I learned a lot and I made several notes to myself here of things I want to look into more or think about when it comes to, you know, my role in the consulting space. So I appreciate you coming on and spending so much time with us.
No problem. Appreciate it. Also, another person to look into is, I think she's a doctor, but Jane Elliott.
Okay.
She's a white woman who does a phenomenal job of teaching racism. By putting on different, like, she's been on Oprah. You can watch one of her sessions and how she splits and divides rooms and shows exactly this is what systemic racism is. And until you feel it or experience it, it's like really, it's just different. But I mean, this is really the only way for things to happen is to have platforms where people actually feel comfortable to dialogue and talk. I learn a lot from that. Because I don't know a lot about white people either. I'm interested. I'm intrigued by a lot of people. But I learned, one thing, when I ask questions, I learned that we all have way more in common than we don't.
That's true. Absolutely. Well, thank you, James. I appreciate you joining us. And I will link to everything down in the show notes for people. Have a fantastic rest of your day, James.
All right. You too.
Thanks again to James for joining the podcast. I really appreciate him spending so much time with me. We recorded a little longer than we even planned because I felt like it was such an important topic. I didn't want to artificially cut it off just to try to meet some sort of random number I have in my head for how many minutes I want to keep these podcasts. What I have decided is I don't want to dilute the message of this podcast by giving a business tip today. Instead, I am going to give you some of my recommendations for books that have been suggested to me if you want to learn more about the Black experience and maybe some of the aspects of being Black and being Black in America that if you are not Black, you maybe have not had your eyes open to before. So I will have those book recommendations in the show notes and on my website, businessofcollegesports.com. If you've got suggestions for future guests or future shows, please email me, Christy@ChristyDosh.com. Shoot me a direct message on Twitter if you prefer, SportsBizMiss. I'll have the link to that in the show notes as well. I love to hear from you all. I so appreciate you spending time with me. Thank you. Have a fantastic week, and I will be back again next week.